haggling fluffy asses and leaping straight down the wolf's throat. Then Riordan materialized in the middle of the crowd, scaring the bejesus out of everyone, and his eyes were weird, like, did his eyes just turn red? Go back. Dancer rewound and I watched it again. Sure enough, and it hadn't been a trick of the moon, Riordan's eyes were pools of blood, backlit by 1,000 icy lanterns. His snarl was abnormally large for his face, all mouth and fangs with barely enough skull to frame it. Horns sprouted on that skull, confirming my teenage suspicions. I leapt to my feet, hands fisting. I knew it. Riordan was the devil. There was no volume, but I could see him snarling at the people in the street. And I didn't need to hear it to know he was saying the same thing I'd be saying. You bloody idiots, why are you killing yourselves? And if you're so hell-bent on dying, go do it somewhere else. Don't fuck with my world. Then all 10 of them attacked Riordan at once. He flung them off, like he was batting ping-pong balls away. They attacked again, and he flung them all off again. And when they realized they weren't going to be able to take him down, they veered like a flock of dim-witted, synchronized birds straight for the black hole. That was when it happened. Suddenly, Riordan morphed. He just bloody transformed in the blink of an eye into one of those great black beasts that fought beside me at the Abbey and had later eaten crimson runes off Cruz. Bloody hell, but I'd been off my game. Not once had I pinned the beast's inexplicable existence up on my bulletin board and examined it. The beasts that Mac said she'd found Silverside were the 9. Riordan was a bloody shapeshifter. He moved in a whirlwind of black-skinned muscle, talons and fangs, ripping, slashing, tearing, gouging. When he was done, he crouched, panting, paws and muzzle slick with blood, surrounded by corpses. Then he dropped back on his haunches, ripped open a thigh, tore off a piece of flesh and began chewing, head swiveling this way and that, to ascertain that no other predators were approaching. I looked at Dancer. He was watching me intently. I got it then. He'd just done to me what I'd done to him when I came in and spooked him, told me what he wanted to say without words.
Can't you see he's an animal, Mega? Choose me.
Dancer knew I was torn between him and Riordan, what they brought out in me, and I pretty much loved him for that, seeing me so clearly. That's something when your friends know who exactly you are. Good, bad, right, wrong, and just keep caring about you. I stared back at the screen, wishing I had a problem with what I'd seen, when pretty much the only thing I was thinking was, so, Riordan's immortal, pens a wicked daily, has super senses, and can shapeshift. Fucker. What else could he do? Years ago, when I'd told him I wanted to be like him, he told me to ask him when I was older. I was older now. 49. I told you I was mean. Mac. When Barons texted me to tell me he'd taken care of my problem with Lore, I was pacing the bookstore so briskly I was practically burning up the carpet, dissatisfied with the way I'd handled things. I'd gone to Barons for help. He'd taken care of it. It bothered me. I didn't want to live that way, always taking cover behind my man from other men. I'd battled my way through assault after trauma, after indignity, and survived them all. I was Queen of the Fae. But even if I weren't, I was a woman that needed to know she could stand on her own 2 feet, toe her line, and demand it be obeyed. Once I transferred the true magic to Cruz, what would I become? Weak again? Never. I liked who I'd become. I wanted to grow and evolve, not backslide. If the 9 knew I needed Barons to protect me, they would never respect me. And I planned to be hanging around them for a long time. I didn't want to be the woman with a strong man. I wanted to be the strong woman. When I called, Barons answered on the first ring. How did you take care of it? I demanded without preamble.
I got rid of the remains. I was in the vicinity of the cemetery and knew I could beat him there.
You got rid of them? I said, dismayed on two counts. One, it only postponed the inevitable. I wasn't going to hide this truth from Lore forever. And two, I had a very human reaction to wanting remains where they belonged, in a grave. I was still disturbed by the vision of my sister's empty casket. How odd was that, worrying about where the bones of our loved ones were. But I did.
I merely moved them elsewhere. You can rebury them at some point,
he growled.
Although I failed to comprehend the desire to make pretty little plots of community and togetherness for decomposing flesh.
I have to talk to him, I said flatly.
I forbid it.
Every cell in my being bristled. I practically shouted, You what?
Forbid it.
You did not just say that to me.
Mac, I know what he's capable of. I know.
So do I. He told me.
Not the same thing,
he said coolly.
Seeing is believing. It took half a bloody century to calm that fuck down. You will not go anywhere near him. I said I'd take care of it, and I did. I will continue to do so. Leave it.
I said nothing.
Mac, don't you fucking hang up on me,
he said staccato fast and heated. I didn't and wouldn't, I growled. Well, I amended, at least I'd say goodbye first. Probably very quickly and nearly inaudible, but hey. Hang on a sec. I sank inward, accessing my files, looking for something similar to the protective barrier Cruz had used the night we sealed away the first Shisadu. I snorted as my mental tabs surfaced. There were several thousand handy little tabs, all names I'd never seen before. Who fucking raw? I sighed. I'd find what I was looking for eventually. At least there weren't 9 million. I returned my attention to Barron's. I'll use a spell to encase myself in a barrier like Cruz did. You couldn't penetrate it that night in the cavern beneath the abbey. He won't be able to touch me, and he'll have to hear me out. Silence stretched, and when he finally spoke, I knew how disturbed I was making him, because his words came out thick and slightly mispronounced. I knew what that meant. His fangs were out.
You're assuming he's capable of reason. If he's the bone crusher, he's not.
I have to try.
I don't like this.
And I don't like needing you to take care of me. I'm not being rash. I'm just being who I need to be. I made this mess. I'll fix it. I'm not sorry I texted you, and I appreciate you buying me time. But I want to be the one to tell him, before he finds out himself. That was what I should have done anyway. But Laura was intimidating when his eyes did that bone-crusher thing.
Your bloody force field won't work.
Cruz's did.
Cruz had the Shisadu by then. Double the power.
It'll work. I'll layer them or something. And don't you dare show up as backup. I'll be fine.
You fucking better be.
Barron's hung up. It took me nearly an hour to sort through files and find a protective barrier that met my criteria of full body and possible to sift while wearing it. Many of the files were nothing more than legends of Fey battles, in which such barriers had been employed. I wasn't surprised to discover wars broke out among the Seelie pretty much constantly, but as the Queen alone had held the spear and sword for most of their existence, they'd raged only until someone drank from the cauldron, then sputtered out, until the next one began. But finally I found suitable armor, donned it, held a mental image of Lore in my mind, and sifted to him. The Queen possessed a far more finely tuned GPS than Christian. I went straight to him. God, this was handy. I wondered if there was a way to transfer the true magic to Cruz while keeping certain powers for myself. I appeared in the graveyard behind the abbey. The night was velvet black with a three-quarter crimson-rimmed moon casting a bloody pall over the cemetery. A study in crimson and shadows, Laura was sitting on Joe's grave, long legs outstretched, leaning back against the headstone, powerful arms bunching, folded behind his head, staring up at the sky, eyes unfocused, as if he'd not even registered my appearance. I knew he had. The fine muscles in his face had tightened minutely. I said nothing. The many things I'd rehearsed in the bookstore abruptly vacated my head.
So, I'm sitting here,
he said finally, real soft.
Thinking to myself that somebody dug up Joe's body recently, 'cause the ground's so loose and the coffin's gone, not even leaving me the lining to sniff. And I'm thinking I only told one person I was coming here to dig her up, and that person standing in front of me, wearing a shield she thinks I can't get through.
I stared at him in silence. A long time passed.
Ain't a fool, woman,
he said finally. I never thought you were.
So I'm thinking, considering I told that person exactly what I meant to do to the fuck that killed Joe, she came here because she wants to die. Do you want to die, honey? Is that why you brought your sweet little ass here to me? Because deep down, you crave death, hunger for oblivion from your many motherfucking sins?
His gaze whipped to mine, and I gasped. There was nothing left of the lore I knew in those eyes. The laughing, playful Viking was gone. Something ancient, dark, and sadistic was all that remained. Right. Talk to me about craving oblivion for my many motherfucking sins. How many people have you killed, Lore? Thousands? Tens of thousands? Who cries justice on you? He surged to his feet in one fluid motion, vanished, then was there, right on the other side of my barrier, as close to nose with me as he could get.
Nobody fucking cries justice on me. We are the law. Always have been. Always will be, babe.
I don't see it that way. I see a man who's gonna die if he kills me. Is that what you want, honey? To die? I mocked. Is that why you brought your sweet ass over to me? Because that's what you're headed for if you think you can exonerate yourself for the deaths of so many innocents, yet fail to extend mercy to me for killing someone while I was possessed by the Shisadu. At least I have the excuse of being possessed. You don't have an excuse. You chose to do those things. Who punishes you, Lore? God? Oh, wait. You'll never die. I see. That's why you think you're the law, because you never have to answer for anything you do. But you're not. None of us are. We fuck up over and over, and we get back up and try to do better. That's all any of us do. Tears stung my eyes. My heart burned in my chest, because seeing the cold marble of Joe's grave and the inscription of her name beyond his shoulder made it all too real. Pain and grief morphed easily to fury. You big dumb son of a bitch, I growled. I loved Joe. You didn't. She mattered to me. She was only a distant possibility of mattering to you. I killed her. You didn't. Who do you think is suffering the most here? 'Cause it ain't you, babe, I said with such vehemence that spittle sprayed on the force field between us. His eyes flared infinitesimally, and he opened his mouth to say something, but I'd gotten started and couldn't stop. Did you think you were gonna find a victim when you looked at me? A woman torn by self-loathing and pity, castigating herself for every wrong she's done someone? Wake the fuck up. That's not me. It's a hard world, and I'm harder in all the right places while still being soft in the important ones. You, my friend, are the one who's fucked up. You skip the whole self-loathing part and flash right into the loathing everyone else. You chuck every soft part that matters and take your pity party to a whole new level. You get stuck in the idiot phase and never evolve beyond it. Oh, poor Lore, who can't love anyone because they all die. You want to look at it that way? Fine, be a baby. Or you could realize that you get to love so damn many people forever. But no, welcome to Laura's pity party. A woman got killed that he might have loved. Not even did love, just might have. So he's gonna wipe out the whole motherfucking planet because he's pissed off and doesn't... His hand was around my throat, choking off my words. The bastard had reached right through my supposedly impenetrable barrier, grabbed me by the neck, and was squeezing. I suffered no hesitation. My brain instantly processed. Baron said, try a rocket launcher. / Laura will always come back. / I'm not anybody's victim and never will be again. / The world has to be saved. / This prick needs to learn to fear me because, yes, I killed Joe, but I'm not dying for it, nor am I putting up with his shit for the rest of my very long life. Then there was an automatic machine gun in my hand, manifested by power I hadn't even realized I was tapping into. I jammed the muzzle into his gut and let it rip. Laura went flying backward through the air, roared, and lunged for me again. I kept firing until he hit the ground and didn't move any more. I watched him until his body vanished, then ground out. I trust I made my point, and sifted back to BB&B. When I returned to the bookstore, Barron's hadn't dropped the wards, but I'd given it wide berth this time, appearing well out in the street. He was sitting on the Chesterfield in the dark, waiting for me. He assessed me and relaxed minutely.
Things went well?
As well as could be expected, I suppose. I told him with a shrug. His eyes narrowed.
He heard you out?
I joined him on the sofa and snorted. Oh, he definitely heard me out. I was nearly done by the time he started choking me. As I stared at him through the low light, a wave of raw, desperate lust flooded me. I needed him now. Kneeling on the cushions, I grabbed his head and kissed him, falling on top of him, taking him back to the sofa beneath me. My body was bristling with energy and savagery and frustration, because I'd really wanted to come to a meeting of the minds with Lore, not have to resort to killing him. But I suspected anything less than killing him simply wouldn't have gotten his attention. And killing him had left something wild in me that needed to be let out. Barron's understood, and met it in kind. Later, I lay in his arms, head on his chest, listening to the peculiar sound of absolutely no heartbeat, and knew he'd leave before long. That was okay. I dumped a pent-up storm of emotion on his body, punished him with it, and let him punish me in return. We ran the full range of sexual appetites in bed, from tender to tortured, white bread to dark, nutty stuff, and it was all good. We were young, strong, and unbreakable. I was fairly certain Barron's was drifting in that deeply inward meditative state he sometimes sought, and was just about to drift off myself when he jolted me awake by saying softly,
"Lore choked you."
I smiled against his cool skin. He always got cool when his heart stopped beating. This was my man, testosterone rising, ready to turn on his own comrades for harming me. But it was unnecessary. I'd held my own. Yes. Deep in his chest, an atavistic rattle stirred.
"I told you that barrier wasn't going to be strong enough. Fey magic doesn't work on us."
"Cruz's shield worked on you, and the Unseely Princess's magic worked on Lore and Riordan's office."
"I told you why his did. The Princess's only worked on Lore because the Sweeper altered her. And that's one fuck we need to get rid of, not the Princess. She's well enough out of the way for now."
He fell silent, and I began to drift again, wondering distantly why the Sweeper was beyond the laws that applied to the Nine. I'd eventually get around to asking, but not now. It was peaceful. I was sleepy, and I had no doubt tomorrow would be another eventful day. As I was fading, he jarred me awake again with an impatient growl.
"Are you going to tell me what the bloody hell you did, or do I have to go find Lore?"
Ooh, we were firmly ensconced in a new phase of our relationship. I beamed. Barron's wanted to know something, hated having to ask, and asked anyway. And it wasn't about an OOP or anything business-related. nor was he dashing off to beat up Lore and avenge the fair damsel. I liked these changes. Sleepily, I mumbled, "I killed him. What did you think I did?" Baron stiffened, went motionless, then stiffened again, dislodging me from his chest, jarring me fully awake. He propped his head on a fist, making all those gorgeous muscles bunch, and stared down at me, the corners of his mouth twitching. "Oh, give it up. You know you want to. Just do it. I know you're badass, and occasional laugh won't disabuse me of the notion." Eyes glittering with mirth, he demanded,
"How?"
I told him. He threw his head back and laughed, white teeth flashing in his dark face. I lay back on the couch watching him, reached up and touched his lips, and he kissed them, then bit gently, then harder. Then he was on me again like a sirocco, gusting over and inside me, taking me down and deep to that beautiful wild place we go when we're alone and free. When he finally got up to leave, the bookstore was carpeted with lush, fragrant flowers and a small tree was blossoming near the sofa. My life was strange. Good, but strange. 50. The illusion has to end this time. Mac. I blew out a frustrated breath and rubbed my eyes. I was tired and hungover. And what a load of bullshit that was. I could handle pretty much anything, but I still needed time to recover from chasing beers with tequila. Admittedly, I chased a lot of beers with a lot of tequila. But late last night, when Alina texted, and I remembered my promise to meet her, there was no way I was missing a chance to hang out in Temple Bar with my sister. We'd talked for hours, about stupid things, about serious things. We'd reminisced, we'd grown maudlin, we'd laughed over silly stories. I told her about her funeral, morbid, and about Barons, amazing, and my past year, traumatic as hell. She told me her story, too, from the day she landed in Dublin to the first time she'd seen a Fae, to discovering what she was. How she met Darok and had loved him almost instantly. Still, from day one, something in her gut had warned her not to confide, so she'd lied about her family and me. Then the Shisadu had begun playing games with her, very similar to those it played when I'd arrived. Together, they'd learned about themselves, my older sister and her beautiful, exotic, fallen Fae, and learned about each other. Over the months, she'd begun seeing significant changes in him, making me wonder briefly what might have happened if I'd met Valain before I'd met Barons. I'd have been fascinated, found him frightening yet somehow irresistible, at least for a time, and might even have tried to convince myself he was one of the good guys, blaming his ruthlessness on his alien nature, maybe even convinced myself I could help him evolve. As Darok had evolved, according to Alina, growing increasingly more human, he lost the vestiges of that fae iciness he'd often evidenced in the beginning of their relationship, that ancient remoteness that had prevented her from telling him many things. He'd become invested in her world, her concerns, and in their future together. When Darok asked her to marry him, although she'd been astonished he was willing to be a part of such a human ritual, she said yes. 2 days later, she'd followed him to 1247 LaRue and discovered who her future husband really was and what he'd been doing all along. When he'd glanced up and seen her, she'd run, certain he would give chase, but he hadn't. She'd walked the streets for hours, finally coming to the decision to call me and return home. He'd broken into her apartment while she was leaving a message for me. She'd been afraid he'd come to kill her, but although they'd fought heatedly, he'd merely stormed out, telling her she needed to pull her head out of her ass and take a good hard look at the world and decide what she wanted. He'd be waiting for her. Hours later, Danny had arrived, telling her that Rowena wanted to meet with her. Numbly, Alina followed. I knew the rest of the story. But there was one thing she told me that I hadn't known. The young She-Seer, who'd led her to that alley that day to die, had ended up crying as hard as Alina. She'd shaken violently, like she was trying to throw off some kind of physical compulsion. She gnashed her teeth, vomited until there was nothing left but bile, torn at her hair, and finally screamed at the end, as if it were she who lay in the alley dying. At that point, I'd begun pounding tequila shots, trying to numb my heart and make it through the night, until I could hug Danny and tell her how much I loved her, and that none of it had been her fault. I'd wanted to go find her as soon as I'd awakened this morning, but I forced myself to postpone it until I'd sorted through at least a few hundred files. More even than I wanted to show Danny my love and support right now, I wanted to ensure she had a long future of it. So I sat on the sofa in BB&B, with a throbbing head, where I'd been sitting for the past 4.5 hours, staring into space, inundated by minutiae and feeling utterly inadequate to the task at hand. The only thing I'd managed to learn about the song so far was that it had come from a completely different source than the true magic. The Fae had no idea who'd given it to them or why. It had been gifted with a single imperative: use it only when you must, and remember, there is always a price. The second part of that imperative made me uneasy. What was the price? My imagination ran wild. Would it kill whoever sang it? If we discovered the song, would I die using it? The rest of what I'd absorbed were nothing but vague myths and legends, some claiming the song was divine, the beginning of life as we knew it, that it had incited the Big Bang. Others claimed it came from a race even more technologically advanced than the Two-A-Day Donna, who had evolved to a higher state of being and passed off the song as a gift to a race they'd viewed as having potential. Each myth, however, shared the common contention that it called due a price. Several seemed to imply that if the race wielding it, there was that damn word again, hadn't done anything wrong, the price would not be high. Wrong was an exceedingly vague word. I'd done many wrong things. Likewise, high was a highly nebulous degree relative to the person it affected. My phone vibrated with a new message from Dancer.
Done. Ready to try it. Meet here or there.
BB&B, I texted back. I'd written several long letters a few months back, one for my parents, one for Barron's, one for Danny. That was before Alina came back, or I'd have written one for her, too. They were upstairs in my bedroom, tucked between two of my favorite books, partially visible. I knew, if I died, either my mom and dad would come look through my things, or Barron's would make sure it got to them. I texted him now. Meet me and Dancer at BB&B. He finished inverting the music. It's ready to try. If I was gonna die today, I wanted Barron's face to be one of the last ones I saw. I didn't, however, want my family to watch it happen. Barron's arrived wearing muddy jeans and a dirty black t-shirt, looking big, rugged, and sexy as hell. I almost never see him slumming, and it always takes my breath away. He somehow looks even more exotic and animalistic in all the right ways in casual clothing. I knew he'd been out there, lying on his stomach, scraping mud from beneath black holes, and I loved that he didn't hesitate to get as down and dirty as necessary to protect the things he cared about. Harshly chiseled, muddy, earthy, and anachronistically human and savage, he turned me on when he looked like this. Who was I kidding? The man always turned me on. Fresh black and red tattoos covered most of his right arm and part of his left, and I knew that while I'd slept, he'd either been tattooing himself, or he and Raiden had been tattooing each other.
"Do you have any idea how to do this?"
he asked, storming in. Then he drew up short, stopping abruptly at the edge of his priceless, restored antique rug, scowling down at his muddy boots. I shook my head, then smirked a little, and invited the mud to vanish from his boots. He raised his head and looked at me, returning the smirk.
"Who's bewitched now? Did you text the others?"
"That would be me," I said pertly. And no, Let's just do it, see what happens. I figured we'd try the sphere by the church. It's the closest. Dancer arrived a few minutes later, carrying a laptop.
I don't know if we need speakers or if this is good enough.
I glanced at him sharply, startled by the dark circles beneath his eyes, and thought again of the elixir of life. As he handed me the laptop, I said, If there was a fey potion that could make you immortal, would you drink it? He cut me a sharp look and scowled.
Christ, does everybody know now?
Pretty much, I said. And don't get prickly about it. We care.
Don't treat me like an invalid,
he said levelly. Not about to. Would you?
No. I've done my share of research into the Fae. Did you know the potion allegedly destroys a human's immortal soul?
I did. And I'd wondered on more than one occasion if Cruz's elixir had the same effect. I hope not. If so, it was too late now, and I had other issues to deal with. I'd worry about the state of my soul later.
I died once. I know what comes next. No way I'm missing it. I've known most of my life that I could die pretty much any time. I'm in no hurry, but it doesn't bother me either. So, are we going to do this? Can we wait for Mega? I texted her, too. She should be here any minute.
Tucking the laptop beneath my arm, I headed for the door. Over my shoulder, I tossed. There's some kind of prize for using it. I'd prefer neither of you came with me. I considered sifting to prevent them from attending, but decided against it. I've become a big believer in free will. Then, Barons and Dancer were beside me, and we hurried from the bookstore into the sunny Dublin afternoon. Not only did the song have absolutely zero effect on the black hole near the church, although I'd sat dreamily mesmerized, feeling like it was definitely doing something to me, when I went to play it a second time, even louder, it was gone. It simply didn't exist on the laptop anymore.
What do you mean it's not there?
Dancer exclaimed.
Give me that thing,
he demanded, reaching for his laptop.
Clearly you're looking in the wrong place.
When I handed it to him, he scanned it rapidly, then began opening folders, digging into root files. I sighed and leaned back against a trash can. The three of us were sitting on a curb, in the gutter, 10 feet from the sphere. As close as we should get, Dancer had warned. After a few minutes of bloody hails and Batman quips, Dancer snapped the laptop shut.
None of my files are here. Not a single one. Every note of the song I recorded, every conversion, inversion, extrapolation, is gone. Even my word docs with theories are gone.
How is that even possible? I've been sitting here wondering if the black hole had somehow managed to eat the music we'd played right down to its source. But if so, it had taken much more than merely the origin of the music, operating like a super stealth spy, wiping out even Dancer's notes about it. He buried both hands in his hair, scowling.
How can you ask me to postulate when I don't even understand the primary suppositions? Bugger! Now I'm going to have to bloody well do it all over again.
Why? It didn't work. That means either the sphere stripped it from your computer or there's something going on here we don't understand. Why recreate a failed experiment? I said pessimistically. I'd had a good feeling about our venture and had expected the music to do something, if not outright make the sphere vanish, maybe shrink it a bit. But when the song had played with no result, I'd grown dismal. Dancer said impatiently,
Because that bastard...
He yanked a hand from his hair and pointed an accusing finger at the sphere.
Took something from me, and I want it back. That's reason enough.
He pushed to his feet, tucked the laptop beneath his arm, and loped off without a backward glance. I looked at Barons. I feel like I did something wrong. I can't shake the feeling this music is what we need, but that blasted wield part of the equation is eluding me. I used the true magic by amplifying it with my fae tethered to the planet. While we were playing the song, I did the same thing, but it had no effect. And now it's gone. What did I do wrong? He extended a hand and pulled me up.
As much as I hate to say it, you need to talk to Cruz. I'll round up the others. Meet back at the bookstore.
Why have a meeting? It's not like we have new information, I said pissily.
Failure is always new information, and those who are willing to suffer it repeatedly make it a stepping stone to success.
Looking up into his steady, dark gaze, I thought about how many times Jericho Barons had pinned his hopes on some new way to end his son's suffering, only to meet with failure. How many millennia had he worked with quiet fortitude toward his goal? I would do no less.
I know why Dancer wants to recreate the music,
he continued.
Inspiration frequently strikes the second or third or tenth time around. The more minds we have working on this, the better. Others can deal with the black holes. We'll figure it out, Mac.
He kissed me then, hard and fast. As he disappeared down the street, I sifted back to BB&B. Barons' plan was for the group of us, Danny, Dancer, me, Cruz, Christian, and Riordan, to sequester ourselves at BB&B until we had the answer. According to him, if I was so certain the music we had was the solution, we just had to figure out how to employ it, determine exactly what wield meant. After Christian and Riordan arrived, Danny and Dancer sped in a few moments later, looking strangely subdued. When they joined us in the rear conversation area, Dancer sat on the sofa, but Danny remained standing with a clear view of the room and summoned Cruz. He appeared instantly, nude, erect, and obviously having sex. He clothed himself instantly in a short iridescent tunic and snarled,
"For fuck's sake, what?"
Before the tension could thicken further, I said hastily, "We tried to use the song from the music box and it didn't work. We need to know why."
"Why have you fixated upon that bloody thing?"
Cruz demanded.
"It is not what you seek. The king was never able to complete the song. Everyone knows that."
"You haven't even listened to it," I pointed out. "How would you know?" He'd sifted out the other night before I played it to the others.
"It doesn't matter anyway,"
Dancer said.
"Listen."
He withdrew the music box from his backpack and handed it to me.
"Or, more accurately, don't."
I shot him a quizzical glance, took the box, sat it on the coffee table, and opened it, bracing myself. Nothing happened. Frowning, I picked up the box, closed it, and opened it again. Still nothing. I closed it, shook it firmly, and opened it again. Not a single note. Not even a whirring of damaged gears. Not that I believed the otherworldly object of power had any gears. What did you do? Drop it or something?
As if. When I got back to the lab and opened it to begin converting the melody again, that's what happened. The song is gone, Mac. Apparently something decided to remove every trace of it from our world.
I shook my head in bewilderment. What the bloody hell was going on? Dancer continued.
It would have been an exercise in futility anyway. I knew when I finished it earlier today that it wasn't complete. It ended abruptly in the middle of an entirely new motif that wasn't an interpretation of any other motif in the piece.
Then why did you bother texting me that it was ready? He shrugged.
Think outside your box. Who was I to presume that wasn't the composer's intention? Perhaps other worlds and races prefer their music to stop in what we consider the middle. Perhaps it excites them to leave it unfinished. I take nothing for granted. You can't, if you want to drive your brain beyond established theory. But now it appears my initial impression was correct, and that's why it didn't work, because we only have part of it.
He muttered.
Had. Now we don't even have that.
I closed my eyes and sank inward, thinking hard. Thinking about how final and odd it was that every trace of the otherworldly melody had simply vanished the moment I'd played the song all the way through to the black hole. It hadn't disappeared each time we'd listened to part of it, nor had it puffed out of existence the moment Dancer had listened to all of it. I found it beyond the realm of probability that there might be an unknown evil entity out there, lurking in the ether spying on us, and the moment we got close to success had seized every note of it, along with every memo we'd made about it. Coupling that oddity with the complete erasure of the music box as well, I found it far more likely that the song had done whatever it was supposed to do, and been programmed to clean up after itself like a self-destructing mission message successfully played by an international high-stakes spy. But what was it supposed to do? An epiphany slammed into my brain and my eyes flew open. Danny was staring at me with such a penetrating gaze, I was surprised it wasn't drilling holes in my face. Our gazes collided, and I knew she'd been following an identical train of thought. Her mouth dropped open, and at the same moment I exclaimed, "I think I've got it," she said. "I think Max got it." We beamed at each other. After a few moments of inner reflection, I was elated to discover I did indeed contain the song. I could feel it inside me, a complex melody thrumming with power. Talk about your checks and balances. Apparently, the Queen was the pre-programmed home for it, and once I'd listened to what we had of it all the way through, which I'd never done until we'd played it near the sphere, it had settled into me, wiping out all trace of its presence, ensuring no one else could ever get their hands on it. I was just about to suggest we head for the nearest black hole and see if I could figure out how to turn myself into a portable iPod when the front doorbell tinkled. The dreamy-eyed guy walked in. "I know how the world works. There's no such thing as coincidence. If you're seeing coincidences, check your suppositions. Somebody's dicking with you, and it's probably not the universe." Each time I'd encountered him flashed through my mind, from our first meeting at Trinity College to the night he'd appeared in the catacomb beneath the abbey and melded back into the unsealed king. Or had he? His skin was the only one that had never dropped to the floor. At the end, the dreamy-eyed guy had merely changed, absorbing the shadows that passed from the falling skins of McCabe and Liz. The news vendor, the leprechaun-like reservations clerk, and my high school gym coach. He'd stretched and expanded until he towered over us, enormous and dark as the Shisa Dew's amorphous beast form. Then he'd vanished with his concubine. What was he, if not one of the king's skins? No single human body could hold the vastness that was the unsealed king.
"Hey, beautiful girl."
"Hey," I said blankly.
"See, you finally stopped talking so much."
"Might have been a bit clearer," I groused.
"Crystal, you muddied it."
"Come to save our world?"
"Hand of God. No fun there."
"What do you consider fun?" I said irritably.
"Free will. Not predictable. Bites you in the ass every time."
He laughed and I shivered, feeling it roll through every cell in my body, and abruptly I was seeing, superimposed around him, a gargantuan ancient star-sprinkled darkness that was so far beyond my comprehension, I felt as tiny as a dust mote, swirling on an air current, sparkling in the sunlight.
"Pretty much,"
he murmured. "And you're the sun," I murmured back.
"Bigger."
I thought of the concubine, of the empty chamber, void of their passion, the slamming door. "She left you," I said sadly.
"Time."
"Changes everything," he didn't say, but I heard it. "So," I prodded, "how do I use the song?"
"Don't have it."
"Got part of it," I insisted. The dreamy-eyed guy rippled into the bookstore in a stain of liquid darkness that licked up the bookcases, swirled on the walls, covered the ceiling, then retreated back into him. His head swiveled. But I saw two visions, the first of the DEG, and the second of a great dark star swiveling in an abyss of dark matter. His gaze moved across our small group, coming to rest on Cruz.
"And he has the other."
I exploded. "What?" I shot Cruz a furious glare. "And you never told me?" Cruz growled.
"The fuck I do, old man. You haven't been hearing music?
The DEG said mildly.
You iced me, you bastard! Complaints. Boring. Music. Yes or no? You never finished it.
Cruz growled.
Or you would have turned your precious concubine into one of us, a thing she was never meant to be. You abandoned us for hundreds of thousands of years, created and discarded us, obsessed with your quest. You betrayed us again and again. Grudges, glories, you name them. They become it.
The dreamy-eyed guy's eyes shifted, expanded exponentially, becoming voracious whirlpools of swirling darkness, sucking us down, stretching us as thin as threads, yanking us away. And abruptly, I stood with Cruz and the dreamy-eyed guy on a familiar grassy knoll beneath an enormous moon, with a pine-board fence unfurling high on a ridge, jutting planks into the sky like dark fingers reaching for the cool white orb. Tiny, between towering black megaliths, I stood with Cruz on my left, the dreamy-eyed guy on my right. The wind tangled hair around my face, while above me hunters gusted a fragrant breeze, gonging deep in their chests to the moon as the moon chimed back. Power pulsed and surged in the soil and rocks beneath my feet, and I could feel it so much more intensely now that I had the true magic. This power was ancient, enormous, far more vast and potent than anything the Earth had ever possessed. I might sink into it, become one with it, become a world myself, or perhaps a star, instead of a mere human or queen. This is the first world, I breathed, understanding. The DEG nodded but looked past me at Cruz.
Your king never betrayed you. That was all you did, at every opportunity.
Cruz snarled.
And now we will see if you are as great a king as he.
I narrowed my eyes, gripped by a sudden inexplicable apprehension. Danger! The marrow in my bones screamed. Wherever this conversation was going, I wasn't going to like it. What did he mean? The king had never betrayed Cruz.
Answer me,
the DEG said softly. But there was such immense compulsion in his words that I instantly began to puke every word I knew in an incoherent babble of random associations.
Not you,
the DEG said absently, and I shut up. Cruz gritted.
Yes, you manipulative fuck. I have been hearing music.
I glared at Cruz. And you didn't think to mention this to me when you knew we were hunting for a bloody song? He shrugged.
I assumed it was miscellaneous detritus from the book. It sounded like the Unseelie Casts, so I believed it part of their true names and didn't give it a second thought.
I narrowed my eyes, trying to decide if he was telling the truth. I was getting a mixed read from him. I turned back to the DEG and scowled. That means you finished it, and you didn't bother to tell us that?
Long before Zara was gone.
I protested. But you didn't turn the concubine. That was the fact that convinced me the king had failed. That he'd not even been an avenue worth pursuing. Now he was telling me he'd succeeded? Then why hadn't he used it? And according to what I understood of the timeline, given how long ago the king had gifted the concubine the music box, he'd had a small eternity to reconsider his decision.
No, the king did not,
he said. And such exquisite pain lanced through me that I doubled over, holding my sides.
There's a price to sing that song.
But you couldn't have sung it. You're not the queen, I protested. He turned his star-filled, apocalyptic gaze to Cruz and smiled faintly.
Rules. Malleable. He could have. He chose not to.
His expression changed to one of paternal pride.
Your turn to choose.
Why are you looking at Cruz? I thought I was supposed to sing the song. His head swiveled back to me, and I got tangled in his enormous regard. Stuck like a fly on sticky tape, unable to move.
You will owe me 3 boons,
he intoned. I nodded instantly. Refusal was not an option.
At the time I come to you next, you will obey without question.
I nodded again.
The music box contained half. The other half was concealed within the Shisadu. It was not,
Cruz growled.
You never finished it. Admit it, you fuck. It was beyond you. I would have known.
I said to the DEG, you mean I could merge with the part I left behind?
It was not in the part that split off and entered you.
So, who's supposed to sing it? Me or Cruz? Our world is ending.
Worlds do. What the fuck is your game, old man?
Cruz demanded.
Will you gift Michaela your half?
The DEG said.
To save my race? Yes. I've always been willing to lead them, as a true king should. But it won't,
the DEG said.
Save your race. It will doom it. The price of perfect song.
His dark, starry gaze encompassed both of us, and suddenly, Cruz and I were standing shoulder to shoulder. He'd moved us together with a mere gaze.
Is the death of all sprung into existence from imperfect song?
I processed his words. Oh, God, you mean... I trailed off, looking up at Cruz with horror. Then I whirled on the dreamy-eyed guy. Shut up, I snarled. Stop speaking right now. But he didn't. He continued driving his point home with utter clarity and finality, ringing the death knell for my world.
The moment the song is sung, the Unseelie race will cease to exist. From the humblest to the most magnificent of his creations. He never betrayed you, Cruz. He betrayed none of his children. He gave up what he held most dear for them.
The DEG smiled with faint bitterness.
And in the end, she left him anyway.
You didn't have to tell him that, I said furiously. At least not until after he gave me the song. You could have lied.
No fun there,
the DEG murmured. Cruz stood motionless for a small eon. My heart grew heavier the longer his silence stretched. Finally, he said bitterly,
you did this on purpose, you twisted fuck. You found a way to box me in. If I refuse to give my half to Michaela, I die. If I give it to Michaela, I die. I die either way. But the Seelie live,
the dreamy-eyed guy said mildly.
You're the one that wanted to be king. Fuck the Seelie. I have always despised them. Dead is not king.
The DEG shrugged.
Never said it was easy.
Abruptly, the DEG was gone, and we were back in the bookstore. Everyone was talking at once, demanding to know what had happened. But my mind was whirling, and I had a sick feeling in the pit of my stomach, because I knew Cruz didn't have an altruistic bone in his body, and he despised the Seelie, and his entire motivation for his entire existence had been to free his dark court. Not kill it. And himself in the process. My gaze whipped to Cruz, and I stared at him imploringly while time spun out. I found my answer in the implacable depths of his sociopathic, self-serving gaze. It was beyond him to suicide. He simply wasn't put together that way. He was a walking fundamental lack, made from imperfect song. The Unseelie were driven by endless consuming hunger to steal that which they lacked in a blind, voracious quest to complete themselves. The Seelie were merely hollowed out by immortality, driven by hunger to experience emotion I was beginning to suspect they'd once known. The Seelie could evolve. The Unseelie never could, trapped in a flawed, limited, self-serving existence. Cruz, give me his half of the song? Never going to happen. He knew I'd found my answer in his gaze and flashed me a glacial smile.
Fuck you and your world, Michaela. If I am doomed,
he said, his eyes narrowing to slits of iridescent ice, And suddenly, I was staring straight into the eyes of the psychopathic Shisadu.
So are you. Along with every Seely in existence. I'll never permit those bastards to outlive my race.
He vanished. Summon him back, I cried to Jada. I whirled on Barons, and seize him when he gets here. I can't, Mac. My cuff, it's gone. So the king said he actually succeeded in recreating the song but didn't use it? Jada said after I filled them in on what had transpired when the DEG whisked us off to the first world. I sank down on the couch, sighing. Yes. I mean, no, not the king. The dreamy-eyed guy kept talking about him in third person, as if he wasn't actually the king.
Then who is he?
Christian demanded. I don't know. Perhaps some part of the king. Whoever he is, he has a great deal of power. He felt like the king to me. He'd taken me to the same planet the king once did. And he put half the song in the music box, and the other half in the Shisadu? Jada pressed. I nodded. But not in the version of the Shisadu that possessed you? I shook my head. The DEG said it couldn't be replicated. Cruz got it, I didn't. And now Cruz is gone, she said, scowling. The cuff vanished from my wrist the instant he sifted out. Now I know why he kept changing the terms of every agreement I tried to make with him. He was never bound to me. He played us, pretending the cuff controlled him, so he could stay close and keep an eye on everything we did. Typical Cruz Lane move, I agreed. They don't call him the Great Deceiver for nothing.
Does that mean the compact the two of you negotiated wouldn't have held up either?
Dancer said. I frowned. Actually, I think it would have, but I can't honor it. He won't survive for me to keep up my end of the bargain, and that voids the agreement.
Tell me again exactly what he said about the price of the song,
Baron said grimly. He said the price of perfect song was the destruction of everything made from imperfect song. Now I understood why my files insinuated that if the race using it hadn't done anything wrong, the price wouldn't be high. I glanced at Barons, who was exchanging a long look with Riordan. What? I demanded. You're thinking something I haven't considered. He studied me a moment, then said carefully,
Assuming that's true, it's not only the Unseelie that would cease to exist, but also anything the Shisadu created. The book was made of imperfect song, containing only spells of imperfect song.
I whispered, Alina, you're saying she'd be unmade too?
Possibly everything turning Unseelie as well.
My gaze flew to Christian.
Bloody great!
Christian said irritably.
And the fuckage of Christian McKelter reaches a new all-time high.
But Christian isn't made from imperfect song, Jada disagreed. He's a human that began to turn fey. I think it's equally possible he would be turned back into a normal man.
That works for me,
Christian said darkly.
Although, given the way my life has been going, I suspect it would be the former. Not the latter. It's possible the song would destroy us as well,
Raiden said.
Depending on precisely what constitutes imperfection and who the fuck is judging it.
I stared at him. Are you fey in some way?
No.
Then why would it affect you?
It could be argued we are anathema to nature,
he said cryptically. Great. So assuming the impossible happens and I manage to sing the song, I'll kill half the people I love. I rubbed my eyes. It doesn't matter anyway. Cruz will never give me his half. He dies either way. He despises the Seely. As far as he's concerned, they don't deserve to exist. He's hated the Light Court for his entire existence. If his choices are to die alone or die taking his enemies with him, it's a no-brainer.
The king could sing it,
Christian said. Good luck finding the bastard, I said darkly. Even if we did, He wasn't willing to sing it for his concubine. He'd never sing it to save the first queen's race. Face it. The two beings capable of saving us never will. I frowned. There is one possibility. I trailed off, not liking it, but willing nonetheless.